So those of you who've never walked into a courtroom before probably have a Hollywood version of what it's like. You know, you script writers can avoid the ordinary conventions of court. So, for example, you have to lay a foundation for a question. Laying a foundation means you have to show through preliminary questions that the piece of information is admissible. You can't build a house out of cards on no foundation in thin air, have it float in the air and be inhabitable. You've got to lay the foundation. You've got to show that a document is admissible because it's otherwise reliable. The court makes a ruling as to its admissibility. Then you can question the witness on it. You can't assume facts, not an evidence. I mean, frankly, from a lay perspective, what goes on in courtroom is so boring. It's like watching ice melt. And so no courtroom reality show really captures the reality of court because it's a high-tech, high-stakes game of three-dimensional chess. But yet, if you are trained to play it, it's one of the most exciting games in town. And it is one of the most intellectually engaging experiences you can have to be in trial. And so trial lawyers watch other lawyers try cases if they can bear it. They watch proceedings in other courtrooms to comment on the technique of other lawyers, to see what they can learn. You know, it's sort of like a professional education. One of my best friends and one of the best personal injury lawyers, maybe my best friend, I don't want to qualify it, is a guy you've heard from on this show named Jim Nugent. He is, in my view, the top personal injury lawyer in Connecticut. Oh, you know, you can say what you want about those firms that weigh their money and advertise broadly throughout the state. But Jim Nugent from New Haven, and you can find him, 203-795-1111. Jim Nugent, 203-795-1111. I can't remember the last time he lost a personal injury case. When he goes to trial, he wins. And because he wins when he goes to trial, insurance companies keep paying him policy limits for the claims that his clients bring. Jim Nugent, welcome back. You were on the show early on. We talked a little bit about the civil justice system. Today, you've been watching the Alex Jones trial from time to time on YouTube, and Alex is on the stand today. What are you seeing in that courtroom? What can you tell us? What can you share?
Well, first off, thank you, Norm, for the kind words. I appreciate it.
They weren't kind words, you jackanape. They were the truth, so just accept the truth.
What percentage do I owe you?
Well, we'll talk about that at dinner. Yeah.
Of course, yes. I have been watching the Alex Jones case about an hour yesterday after I was informed that it's a live stream, and then again another hour and a half this morning as I'm doing work. It's very interesting with Alex on the stand. He obviously is a very colorful and combative person and witness. But there are some takeaways that I've been observing on the computer.
What surprised you most? So you're watching it via Google, and you know, nobody should. Everybody, you should keep your attention on us. This is WICC 600 AM, 107.3 FM, WICC600.com. This is where it's at. This is the epicenter of the intelligent universe. There are circles surrounding us, concentric circles, and one of them is the proceedings in the Alex Jones case that are being live-streamed, I think, via YouTube. Isn't that right, Jim?
Yes, it is YouTube.
Okay. Well, anyhow, and I think it's the 459th Judicial District of Travis County, Texas, live stream. So it's 459 Judicial District, Travis County, live stream. So after this show is over, you'll go to watch some of it. It'll be recorded. People will be talking about it. What kind of witness is Alex? And you know I represent him. And so, you know, don't bother hurting my feelings. What are you seeing in that courtroom today as a forensic matter, as a matter of contested litigation in a courtroom, in an open court?
Well, first off, I'm confused and befuddled as to why he's even on the witness stand. He apparently is the last witness of the trial, the one and only witness of the defense. So his own lawyer called him as his only defense witness, and the trial is going to end upon his completion as a witness. The information that the plaintiff lawyer who's cross-examining him has is voluminous. Apparently, the guy's always on radio or on television running his mouth. And it
I can't understand why anyone would do that. Can you understand? Why would anybody get on a radio or television every day and run their mouth, creating a long record that will follow them to the grave? I can't imagine why anybody with half a brain would do it. Oh, but I have a whole brain.
That's right.
I guess, yeah. Well, but anyhow.
Alex didn't have to wait until the grave. He had the troubles cast upon him today for what he was running his mouth just last week on. Apparently, last week, as shown to the jury, he was on his television and radio talk show with a picture of the presiding judge.
Oh, no, Judge trial. Gamble?
Yes, on fire.
Wow.
So he has her going up in flames because it was just a simple injustice. The entire trial is an injustice.
So this video was shown. Wait. This video, the video of a picture or a symbol of Judge Gamble going up in flames was shown to the jury while Judge Gamble's on the bench?
Yes.
How did she react to that?
She just sits there stoic and just rules whatever, basically 99% of whatever the plaintiff wants, he gets, and the defense is obviously overruled just about every single time. But if that wasn't bad enough, and of course the question was whether or not, the question on cross-examination was whether or not he was taking this case seriously. Alex indicated he was taking it as serious as cancer. And then it was the judge going up in flames and some other judge that he's also unhappy with also going up in flames. But the worst part of it was that he was shown a video to impeach him in which he was criticizing the jury, saying that half the jury was from a blue-collar bubble. And that they didn't know who he was, that they live in a bubble, they're just blue-collar people, and it just really did not play well in Alex's favor when the jury, the actual jury, apparently half of whom are blue-collar and living in a bubble, was criticized by Alex.
So you used an interesting term, and I want to make sure our listeners get a sense of what a lawyer looks at when they look at courtroom testimony. What does it mean to say impeachment? What does it mean to impeach a witness?
Basically, that what he said today is not consistent or inconsistent with what he said previously. So in this particular case, yes.
Why? So if he say if the proposition he's being impeached on is that he was not taking the trial, that he says, I'm taking this trial very seriously, I'm taking it to heart, it's like a cancer. Why would his commenting on the juror and saying that half of them live in a bubble, they're blue collar bubble? Why would that be impeachment? Why is that not collateral? In other words, why is that not related?
I thought it was a very good objection that it was a collateral issue. And it doesn't really matter that on a 403 balancing scale.
I'm going to stop you because you're sounding like a lawyer. A 403 balancing scale. When I get on my scale in the morning, if it said 403, I'd have a heart attack. I've put on some pounds over the years, but not that many. So you're saying when you say 403 balancing code analysis, you're talking about the code of evidence, and you're saying that when a lawyer offers a piece of evidence, it has to be not just relevant to the issue that's being decided and material. That means it must matter or shed some light on an issue that a fact finder must decide. But there is also the potential that its undue prejudice might unfairly affect a person's fair trial rights. And so that even though a piece of evidence might be otherwise admissible, a jury might not see it because of the danger it carries of unfair prejudice. That's what you were referring to by 403B, I presume?
Yes. Couldn't have said better.
Of course it couldn't, but we've tried cases together. I've seen it said better. Usually when you're saying it after I'm, frothing at the mouth on the floor and I'm upset about something and I'm like, Jim, can you handle this witness? Because I'm so upset, I don't think I could speak straight. And you look at me with that smile and you say, what, we go forward. That's our mantra,
forward.
Right? We go forward.
Yeah.
But in any case, so this is the camera in the court. There is a live camera in the courtroom, obviously. Are you able to see the reaction of jurors to this information?
I am not able to see the reaction of the jurors, although there appears to be two cameras in the courtroom. One is pointing, basically mounted on the ceiling, I think, behind the jury box. But as we look out basically seeing what the jury box is seeing. There's a camera pointed on the opposite end of the opposite side of the room directly at us. So I assume the jury is being filmed. Interestingly, during a court break, when the jury filed back in, I was able to see them all, their faces.
And what did you see?
Which I thought,
Can you read anything?
The people were.
Yeah.
No, they were just, the court was not in session. They were just taking their seats. But I was somewhat surprised. I don't think the very few cases that are televised in Connecticut, the judge would allow the jurors' faces to appear during the trial on the live stream.
Yeah, well, Judge Gamble is kind of running roughshod over a lot of things that are where care would be taken of in Connecticut. But I'm not a Texas lawyer, and I can't comment on what goes on in the Lone Star State. There was a shocking revelation just before you became on the air, or just before you came on the air today. What happened?
It was said, basically, it was just the statement by plaintiff's counsel. He was cross-examining Alex Jones and asked him if he had complied with discovery, like he said yesterday afternoon on direct. Alex said yes. The lawyer then said one of the jobs in discovery was to give us all your text messages with regard to Sandy Hook. He said yes. He said, did you do that? He said, yeah, best of my ability. I gave my phone over, and the tech people, you know, searched it. At that point, the plaintiff lawyer showed him some other texts that were inconsistent with what Alex said. He said,
"I mean, text of his." Okay.
Text
let's
from
talk,
Alex Jones.
Let's talk about this after the break. I'm told that it's time to pay obeisance to the ad man, so that everyone listening to WICC 600 AM, 107.3 FM, WICC600.com will purchase these products and help keep us on the air, so that we can deliver the truth, the incisive comment and insight that you've come to depend on. I get such a kick out of some of the teasers, you know, right before I got on the air. I'm here to tell you what's really going on. Wow, I wish I knew sometimes what was real and what was appearances. We talked about that last week in response to a caller's question. I'm not going to go down that rabbit hole today. We're talking right now with Jim Nugent. In my view, for my money, the state's top personal injury lawyer. If you get banged up in a car wreck or a trucking accident or something happens that you don't think was right and you've got a serious physical injury, give Jim a call at 203-795-1111, 203-795-1111. I can't recall the last time a jury said no to Jim, and I do know it to be personally true. Well, not personally. I've never been personally injured and needed a lawyer. I do know that insurance companies would rather settle with him and usually pay their policy limits than go to trial. Jim's been telling us about some of his observations of Alex Jones on the witness stand in the trial currently underway involving Neil Heslin and Scarlett Lewis, the parents of a young man, a little boy, killed in the Sandy Hook shooting on December 14th, 2012. And just before the break, he was telling us that some text messages had found their way to the plaintiff's lawyers, the lawyers suing Alex, and Alex was being confronted with them. Jim, pick up where we left off. What did you see, and what was your reaction to it?
All right, yes, it was somewhat of a bombshell, and it was just a speaking statement, not objection, not question, by the plaintiff's lawyer. So he was cross-examining Alex with regard to his knowledge that his conspiracy that Newtown didn't happen was a farce. And there were texts to Alex, apparently, from a gentleman within his organization saying it's a farce. But those texts were not turned over to plaintiff's counsel. Alex was arguing, what do you mean it wasn't turned over? You have them. How can you accuse me of not complying with discovery when you have what you're saying I didn't give you? And that was when the plaintiff's lawyer dropped the bombshell saying, you didn't know that 12 days ago your lawyer sent me two, three, four gigabytes of documents by mistake that were not marked privilege or attorney-client confidential, and I got them, and that's where I found it. So you had these texts all along and didn't give them to me.
Wow,
I got them by mistake.
Yeah, and I want to make clear that I wasn't that lawyer. I'm not the lawyer in Texas. I'm reading a statement that appears on Twitter. Bankston, that's the lawyer. I refer to him as the Pillsbury Doughboy, but I have you know, I'm a contestant in this case. Bankston, did you know 12 days ago your lawyers messed up and sent me an entire digital copy of your entire cell phone with every text message you've sent for the past 2 years? And when informed, in other words, when the lawyers were informed, they did not take steps to identify it as privilege. So let's unpack this a little bit for listeners. If you are my lawyer and I communicate with you about the case, those communications are cloaked or covered by something called the attorney-client privilege, right? Right, Jim?
Yes, that's right.
Well, what's the purpose of the attorney-client privilege, and what is the effect of the attorney-client privilege? In other words, what use
does it have? The main purpose is that whatever you tell your lawyer, you can tell freely, openly, honestly, and thoroughly without fear that it's going to be used against you.
Okay.
So you can have frank discussions. Your lawyer can ask the tough questions. You can tell your lawyer all the information so that proper trial strategy can be developed without fear that those discussions will later be subject to disclosure to your opponent.
What happens if you suppose, though, in this case, as apparently happened, one of Jones's lawyers, one of his Texas lawyers, hit the send key on a series of documents and sends otherwise privileged communications to his adversary? What happens then?
Well,
is the privilege waived?
You know, that's interesting. Well, what is interesting is that they sent documents that were being used during the trial, apparently that should have been sent years ago. So it's hard to claw back what you said didn't exist in discovery and you were ordered to produce and apparently may have been defaulted as a result of not producing it. And then lo and behold, 12 days ago, you produced what you should have produced. So,
yeah, but you're never supposed to produce. You're never supposed to. I don't think you're supposed to produce privileged stuff. My understanding is, I had this happen the other day where, you know how you know in an email there are strings of communication. So you and I, you may send me an email 3 days ago. Who do you think is going to win the ball game that's taking place today? We might exchange emails during the ball game, and you know during the third quarter, I might say, it looks like it looks like the Wolverines are going to drop another one to the Ohio State Buckeyes, And when I send you that last email, all the emails in that string get included. And it may be that in one of those earlier emails, there was a communication that related to a case we're handling. And so if I send that last email and see that there's a privileged one in the string, I have a right to claw the privileged piece back to provide the other side with notice that they've received something privileged and they have an obligation to return it. We might argue before a judge whether the judge should review that and whether it is in fact privileged. But the court takes very seriously and goes to extraordinary lengths to protect the privilege. I don't know what the doughboy is saying down there in Texas is correct, but he's claiming that he got information, that he looked at it, it appeared to be privileged, and he notified the defendant's lawyer, Jones's lawyer, that there were things in there that he might want to take a look at, and the lawyer didn't respond. That doesn't look good. That's not a good look, you know?
It doesn't look good. Of course, one of the things that I was thinking was whether or not it was truly an inadvertent production to him.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps, you know, 12 days beforehand, you do the dump truck document dump saying, well, either for appellate issues or sanction issues, you can't say we didn't give you everything. We're just going to wait 12 days before the end of the trial so that you don't have time to go through everything.
All right. And so that's a litigation tactic that you do a dump of a large amount of data before the other side has the chance to go through it fully, and lawyers have a duty to continuously disclose items that they discover in their possession that the other side is entitled to. So it may be that this was a litigation tactic. Have you been able to watch any of the trials since this disclosure took place, or have you been spending all your time talking to us?
I've spent all the time since then on the phone with you.
Well, I can't imagine time better spent than that. What do you think is going to happen? What do you think is going to happen in the Texas trial? Do you have any predictions on what the verdict will be? And if so, if it's going to be a plaintiff's verdict? Well, I guess there's been a liability finding by, as a result of a discovery default. That is, the court concluded that Mr. Jones did not comply with discovery and she entered a default, meaning he could not contest liability. The jury doesn't, I don't think the jury knows that. They've simply been told that certain facts have been established. That's not technically speaking true. The default means that the facts pled were deemed to be true as a result of the default. In other words, Jones lost the right to defend them. That's a different thing than saying that they've been proven, but you know that I may be driving too fine a point on it. So the jury's there to decide how much damages to award. I guess the question is, do you think they're going to award damages, and can I put you on the spot and ask you to come up with a number so that we can revisit it after the verdict is returned?
Sure. A couple of issues, though, or highlights I want to point out is that I haven't watched any of the trial other than an hour yesterday and about an hour and a half this morning, and it has been exclusively Alex Jones as the witness. Based on that and that alone, they're in trouble. The defense is in major trouble. However, one of the points that I want to raise is the fact that although he's been defaulted and found to be either negligent or defame these people, I think a key issue, and I'd like to see the jury instructions, is causation. And whether or not his defamatory statements or negligence, so to speak, caused these people any injuries or damages. And I think that's why I read in the newspaper they had a psychologist come in as an expert saying this was the most devastating thing to happen to him. To bridge that gap, there has to be the medical or psychological link of the defamatory statements causing harm, causing the damages. Assuming that bridge has been built and crossed, I would think that based on, especially when you're telling half the jury that they live in a blue-collar bubble, which was cast in a, I would say, a very unfavorable light of the jury, that you may have lost the jury for good there. Mm. And you're the only defense witness, so it's not like you did yourself any favors, and he's still being grilled on cross. They very well may say, hey, the plaintiff's asking for $150 million. The only other number we have is a $1. We're just going to go with what they say. There's an anchoring of the $150 million that it's going on in the jury's mind. And if they have put on a good, strong case, and the defense hasn't knocked any kinks in the armor, I could see it coming in just as the plaintiff requests.
That would be a shocking event and might or might not have a bearing on what happens in the Connecticut trial, which was expected to start with jury selection yesterday and was delayed, largely as a result of something I filed. And I'll be happy to explain that in non-prejudicial terms in a moment. Why do you say no like that? Why do you gasp incredulously and in disbelief, Mr. Nugent?
I think because of a conversation we had probably 10 years ago now, in which you were bemoaning the fact that just about every case that the government prosecutes against your clients takes much longer than anticipated.
Yeah, I just can't. I don't understand why that is. It just drives me crazy, you know?
And we only found one common denominator.
Yeah, what was that again?
You.
Oh, yeah, there is that. Well, you know, I just can't tiptoe or tap dance my way into a courtroom with one arm tied behind my back. I like to say to prosecutors when a case begins, you know, here I am. You've accused my client of whatever it is you've accused my client of. And there are two ways we can work this case out, my way or the hard way. I'll let you pick, but be careful what you choose. Jim Nugent, thanks for joining us. Go back and watch more of that trial. I want to know what you think. I'll be on the line with folks here or on the air with folks here till about 2 o'clock. Hey, so we've been kicking around what we just started to kick around, a little known clause of the 14th Amendment. It's the disqualification clause. And let me read it to you again and wondering whether this is what is going on in the January 6th committee. The 14th Amendment, as you know, was passed in the wake of the Civil War, and its premier section, Section 1, guarantees to all the equal protection of law and due process of law. And these are some of the hallmarks of what makes America great. Every person, regardless of race, color, creed, status, orientation, personal pronoun, this, that, or the other thing, is to be regarded as equal before the law. That's the point of saying that we are a government of laws and not men. We don't have the discretion to say, hey, look, I don't like you, therefore the law doesn't apply. That is what equal protection means. Due process means that everybody is entitled to be treated fairly under law. We don't say that some people get fewer rights than others because of their status. Because all people enjoy equal status, all people have equal access to all the process, that is, all the protections and remedies that the law offers. Section 3 of the 14th Amendment was an amendment passed to help the country get over, as it were, the effects of the Civil War. The South succeeded. They attempted to take the view by firing on Charleston that when the states joined the Union, they retained the right to leave it. They wanted effectively a divorce from the Union, and the Union said, you can't divorce us. This Union is eternal, was meant to last for the ages. And the secessionists said, well, no, you know, we entered into a contract in the same way that individuals enter into contracts with the government and reserve the right to withdraw from it. That is, to take an appeal to heaven and resist, as Jefferson counseled, when government became tyrannical or it acted independently of the people's interest as the people perceived it, the people were free to leave. So the South packed up to leave. Abraham Lincoln talked about the mystic bonds of union, whatever those are, and he suspended habeas corpus, that is, the right of people to go into the courts to challenge the activities of the federal government, to say that the federal government was acting unlawfully in detaining them. And we had the bloodiest war ever on this continent. Some 600,000 Americans lost their lives fighting brother against brother, family against family. And in the end, the North won. The country had to be put back together again. And in the 13th Amendment, slavery was abolished. In the 14th Amendment, we created equal protection and due process of law as a matter of constitutional right, making it the supreme law of the land. The 15th Amendment extended these Reconstruction aims in other ways. Tucked within the 14th Amendment was a consideration. What do we do? What do we do if a former Confederate officer who, let's say, previously had been a member of Congress, had been a member of the Union, and swore to protect and uphold the Constitution, if that person now, after the Civil War, seeks to run for office, can we trust him? Can we, you know, what, your spouse once having said, I want a divorce, I'm out of here, you're awful, and opened fire on you in that rhetorical war, battle of words that is divorce. Do you bring her back? Do you love her again? Some people find the means to do that, and wow, I say that's fantastic. I mean, love is a mystery, and its close cousin hatred is apparently as mysterious. But as our federal constitution goes, the founders said, or the drafters of the Constitution said, look, once a person has held office in the United States, and this would include the president, and has sworn an oath to uphold the Constitution of the United States, to support the Constitution, the amendment reads, and if that person has engaged, this is the language, and let me read the language, shall, quote, have engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the same, or given aid or comfort to the enemies thereof, that person is ineligible to hold office again. So here's a question. If the January 6th committee concludes that Donald Trump engaged in insurrection or gave aid or comfort to enemies of the United States, will that be enough to keep him off the ballot, or does a court need to make that determination? It's an open question. I don't have the answer. Laura from New Haven has just called in. Laura, welcome. I don't know if you have the answer or you want to raise another issue or whatnot, but welcome to the show.
Hi, Norm. It's so nice to be on your show.
Well, thank you.
I have a question for you regarding Alex Jones.
Right.
So I'm just trying to understand. They're suing the media because Alex Jones lied about something that happened to their families, and I get that. Does the same go forward with, say, Trump being told, everyone being told that Trump colluded with Russia, which they've proven is not true?
It actually does.
Can you sue the media for that?
You can. So
I would hope so.
So, you know,
it's a terrible thing. I lived in Oxford when that terrible tragedy happened.
Mm.
And, you know, I know it happened. And I think Alex Jones was wrong and a conspiracy theorist for saying that. However, we have a lot of conspiracy theorists on our media who just make up all kinds of things. And, you know, as far as the January 6th stuff, no one is allowed to hear about that video, 2,000 Mules, which case after case, they see people doing things with ballots. And, you know, I just think if more American people had or could be exposed to that, I think they would feel quite differently about what happened at the election.
The 2,000 Mules film you're referring to, I'm drawing a blank on the person who created it. Can you help me with that?
Dinesh D'Souza.
Yeah, Dinesh D'Souza. So he's done a film called 2,000 Mules. I think it's a couple hours long. And in it, I've not seen it. And in it, he shows what he believes and many believe to be compelling video evidence of electoral ballot fraud by mules. By people who were engaged in conduct that was intended to tip the balance in favor of Joe Biden by fraudulent manipulation of the ballot. And, you know, candidly, Laura, I hope you'll keep listening once I say this. I haven't watched the film because at some level I don't care. I mean, that was 2020. The future's ahead of us. We're not going to declare that election invalid. At most, all we can do is try to make the future elections better and eliminate fraud. I don't particularly care for Biden. In fact, I don't care for Biden. I didn't vote for him. I don't like what his administration is doing. And I'll certainly vote again in 2024. But litigating endlessly the 2020 election just doesn't do it for me, you know. And so
I agree with you wholeheartedly.
All right.
My passion is that I feel that the public we need free speech. We don't need censorship. And I think going after a sitting president from the day he took office about Russia, and when the proof came out that there was no collusion and that there were some very nefarious things going on, we should also have had the opportunity to hear that. And we haven't been.
Well,
I'm a newsie.
Maybe not. I'm going to ask you to hold. I'm going to address this in a more respectful way with some analysis of what the Jones case is involved, and what remedies Trump may have if he chooses to use them when we return from the break. You're listening to WICC 600 AM, 107.3 FM, WICC600.com if you're live streaming. So we've been talking about Alex Jones today. We've been talking about Donald Trump, the January 6th committee, whether Donald Trump will be disqualified from running for president in 2024 if the January 6th committee concludes that he engaged in insurrection. And in the midst of this discussion, Laura from New Haven called. I hope you're still on the line, Laura. Thanks for waiting.
Yes, I am.
So you raised a question about whether Trump, you know, so Alex Jones has been sued for uttering false statements about the Sandy Hook shootings. And you raised the question whether those who uttered false statements about Donald Trump and the Russian collusion can be sued. And the answer is yes. And then you raised a related question about whether this entails or involves censorship. And I'm going to argue that the answer is maybe, but it's not as obvious as you think. So let me explain these in two parts. First, there are many who claim that the Alex Jones case is not a First Amendment case at all, that when Alex talks about this being a defense of the First Amendment and shows up in court in Austin with a piece of duct tape over his mouth that says, you know, protect 1A, I think it's what it said, that he's mischaracterizing the litigation. The First Amendment preserves the right to freedom of speech, and it says that Congress shall make no law regarding, you know, freedom of speech or restricting speech. But it doesn't say anything about the states or about municipal governments. Along the way in our history, though, the First Amendment has been incorporated or applied to the states such that the language Congress shall make no law means the Connecticut legislature, means the town of Trumbull, New Haven's council, yada, yada, yada. Among the laws, and so no government can make a law abridging freedom of speech. The Supreme Court has acknowledged certain exceptions to freedom of speech in its case law, and those include defamation, those include true threats that you might make to a person, those include inciting others to violence, those include using words to cause intentional infliction of emotional distress. These issues get litigated from time to time. So in this last case, the infliction of emotional distress, members of the Westboro, I believe it was, Baptist Church, were sued by veterans' families whose children had lost their lives in wartime service when at a funeral, members of the church turned up with signs that said, your son died because this is God's judgment on homosexuality or stuff like that. And they said, this is just outrageous. Nobody should be permitted to say that. And the United States Supreme Court said in a case called Schneider versus Phelps that this is protected speech. So when the Supreme Court says that something is protected, that means it's perfectly capable of being uttered. You're free to say it. Prohibited speech is speech you can't utter. So if I were to say something notorious and scandalous about you, Laura, online or here on air, in a way that permitted the public to identify you but that damaged your reputation, and if I said it in reckless disregard of the truth or knowing full well that it wasn't true, you could sue me for defamation or damage to your reputation. If you could show that I did so with the intent to cause you serious emotional distress, you might also be able to sue me for something called intentional infliction of emotional distress. Those are both torts, that is twisted or wrongful behavior, that every state permits a citizen to pursue and that the United States Supreme Court says it does not violate the First Amendment. So, from the standpoint of the Sandy Hook families in both the Connecticut and Texas litigation, Jones uttered things that he knew to be untrue, that he lied, that's the expression they'll use, or that he was recklessly in disregard of the truth. Anybody in their right mind should have known that these parents weren't crisis actors and their kids actually died. Only a person who didn't care at all about the truth would utter such things. Neither of those speech acts on Jones's behalf. Yeah, you're welcome. Neither of those speech acts are protected speech. Both are prohibited. And so with respect to the Trump claims, he could sue anybody who said he colluded with Russia. And Laura, I think you're going through a checkout line. You may want to sign off. We'll get you another time. But with respect to Trump, he has the ability to sue anybody who he believes intentionally stated something false against him or acted in such a way that was in reckless disregard of the truth. His options might be limited somewhat, though, because lawmakers who make such claims while in legislative session have a privilege. They have the right to speak their mind, and they are immune from defamation suits. So if your state senator gets on the well of the state Senate and says something truly horrific about you, defames you, but he says it in the course of a senatorial debate, the law says that's privileged. And we recognize that privilege because we want to promote full and robust debate on the floor of the House. That legislative privilege is designed to preserve the interest of the common good. So it's a complicated question. Those on the plaintiff's side of the aisle in the Sandy Hook case say that Jones's speech was not protected, that characterizing this case as a First Amendment case mischaracterizes it. This is an ordinary tort case. From the standpoint of the Sandy Hook plaintiffs, Jones is as guilty, is as much a tortfeasor, a person who committed a tort. He's every bit the tortfeasor that a guy who drives his car into a group of children is without looking at the stop sign or not caring whether a stop sign is there. And it's not a First Amendment issue at all. Those are the simple answers to the questions that Laura posed. Is this censorship? You know, I represent Jones, as you know, in Connecticut. And it is my view that he was defaulted in this case for not complying with discovery. Judges ruled that he deliberately withheld information from the other side in the litigation. And as a consequence of that, the result is that liability has been determined absent any requirement for the plaintiff to prove it. The courts have ruled that because he did this, because he did not comply with discovery, he deprived the plaintiffs of their ability to prove the case. And as a consequence of depriving them of the ability to prove the case, even if it wasn't true, but describing them the ability to try, the result is that he's been defaulted and jurors will be told, as they were in Texas, that he's liable. That's the consequence of the court's ruling. His position is that's not what happened. Jurors may or may not be told that. That's going to be up to the judge to make that ruling. And is this censorship? You know, Jones contends it is, that he's been singled out because he's unpopular, that the Sandy Hook communications he engaged in are a tiny, a minuscule part of his overall communications, and that he's only being targeted with this litigation as a desire or as an effort to put him out of business because he is a critic of the mainstream media, a critic of the forces that run the world. So that's sort of the backstory. You know, as you're reading coverage of this or listening to it and hearing people take different perspectives, I offer you these thoughts, and this was my best effort to render them in a neutral way so as to not take sides. I'm aware that this is the range of debate. Depending on who you support, you may feel yourself drawn to one side of the debate or another. But I think if you want to engage in a real discussion about what's going on here, you have to acknowledge the range of opinions and that there are honest people on both sides of this, and they may weigh different values in the conflict and reaching the conclusions that they do. Back to this question of Trump, though. If a congressional committee concludes that Donald Trump engaged in insurrection, will that bar him under the 14th Amendment from serving or for running for office? Would he be disqualified? I say it would not. And I say it would not because that's not really an opportunity where the issue of whether he engaged in insurrection had been fully and fairly litigated. Due process, remember that guarantee from Section 1 of the 14th Amendment, that no person shall be deprived of liberty or property without due process of law, without fair process, without an orderly procedure? That would require a finding where Donald Trump had a right to defend himself. And one of the things that has been absent notoriously in the January 6th committee is any cross-examination of witnesses. Any right of Donald Trump or those who are associated with him to defend himself in front of the committee. There's a powerful argument that the committee itself is unlawfully constituted because under the House rules, that is the rules of the House of Representatives, and I remind you that this is a House committee on the attack on January 6th, under House rules, a committee, a properly constituted committee, and this is a term of art, a properly constituted committee shall, and that's a word that means it must, have minority representation. In this case, House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy from Florida suggested to Nancy Pelosi certain House Republicans that the House Republican caucus, that is the Republicans in the House, wanted on the committee to assure adequate minority representation. Nancy Pelosi refused to sit, the House leadership under Democrat Party control, refused to sit the minority representatives that the minority wanted on there, and instead hand-selected two Republicans that arguably were rhinos, Republicans in name only, including Liz Cheney from Wyoming, to sit. So while it's fair to say there are a couple Republicans on there, they're not the Republicans that the Republican majority or the Republican minority or the Republican caucus, rather, wanted on the committee. Nancy Pelosi wouldn't sit them. So there is a good argument that this committee is improperly constituted and that it really doesn't have authority as a matter of law. There are some pieces of litigation pending before the courts, and this issue has not yet been decided. Candidly, it's unlikely to be decided in favor of those challenging the authority of the committee. I think people want answers about what happened at January 6th, and this committee, though flawed, will give us answers of a type. They've promised us that they will show that Donald Trump was engaged in an attempted coup. Thus far, there has not been anything close to that level of truth or proof. I don't think they're going to be able to reach a responsible conclusion that Mr. Trump engaged in insurrection because I don't think that there's proof of any broader conspiracy to engage in insurrection. So I think that if the committee concludes that Donald Trump engaged in insurrection, there will be those that argue that that finding prohibits him from running for office. I think he could go to a court and have that finding declared invalid or of no legal effect for the reason that his rights to due process were avoided were abrogated in that context. He was not given an opportunity to appear, to defend himself, to cross-examine the witnesses against him. Did he give aid or comfort to the enemies of the United States?